voters seem to be upset with Trump and Republicans, especially on the issue of affordability.
The latest NPR PBS News Marist poll shows some warning signs for Republicans heading into the 2026 midterm elections.
For Friday, November 21st, it's All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Scott Detrow. The Border Patrol has become the face of the Trump administration's immigration enforcement campaign in cities across the country.
I think the Border Patrol for the president and the White House is kind of the next best thing to a military deployment.
And a new skincare company is marketing products for kids.
I really thought that children were off limits in terms of the marketing and greed of the beauty industry, but apparently not. And that's how you know we've entered late stage capitalist hell.
And the online gaming platform Roblox is rolling out facial age verification to enhance security.
What do parents need to know to keep their kids safe?
First, this newscast.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Ryland Barton. The Coast Guard is taking a more firm public stance against the display of nooses, swastikas, and other hate symbols. That's after outcry over a new policy that appeared to downgrade the severity of them. Steve Walsh with member station WHRO in Norfolk has the deals.
As details. First reported by the Washington Post, the Coast Guard released a new harassment manual which labeled things such as displaying the Confederate flag as merely divisive. The manual also eliminates a standalone process for investigating instances of hate. The Coast Guard pushed back at the idea that the policy had been weakened, but late Thursday issued a new policy saying that nooses and swastikas and other symbols of hate must be removed from all Coast Guard facilities. The Department of Defense has been going through a similar process of reviewing hazing, bullying, and harassment definitions across the military, but has not released a policy. For NPR News, I'm Steve Walsh.
The State Department says Nigeria is taking seriously the Trump administration's concerns about attacks on Christians. A Nigerian delegation was in Washington this week, as NPR's Michelle Kellerman reports.
Earlier this month, President Trump warned that he would stop all aid to Nigeria and may go into the country, quote, guns a-blazing to stop terrorists from killing Christians. State Department officials say the Nigerians heard U.S. concerns and sent a high-level team to Washington to meet Pentagon officials and the Deputy Secretary of State, Christopher Landau. Republican Congressman Riley Moore says he had what he calls frank, honest, and productive talks with the Nigerian delegation, too. He says the Nigerians have a chance to deepen relations with the U.S. if they prioritize the protection of Christians. Michelle Kellerman, NPR News, the State Department.
As Americans start traveling for the holidays, the proportion who have gotten their annual flu and COVID-19 vaccinations remains low. NPR's Rob Stein reports.
Only about 14% of adults and less than 6% of children have gotten one of the updated COVID-19 vaccines, according to the CDC. And only about one-third of adults and kids have gotten their annual flu shot. That's despite the fact that the U.S. is less than a week away from Thanksgiving, when many people will travel and gather with friends and family. The good news is that so far, there aren't a lot of people catching COVID and flu right now. But flu is on the rise, and COVID is expected to also pick up soon. Rob Stein, NPR News.
The Trump administration is suing California for providing in-state college tuition to students who don't have legal status. Backers of the law say students generally were brought to the U.S. when they were children and are as much a part of their communities as U.S. citizens. Similar lawsuits have been filed against other states. You're listening to NPR News from Washington. The widow of Washington Post journalist Jamal Khashoggi is calling for the release of the transcript of a 2019 phone call between President Trump and Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. She's joining Democratic lawmakers who are raising questions about what Trump may have received in exchange for his embrace of the Crown Prince. Trump has dismissed U.S. intelligence findings that Prince Mohammed authorized Khashoggi's killing. Senate Democrats are investigating leadership at the John F. Kennedy Center for the Performing Arts for what it calls cronyism and corruption. The center's president, Ambassador Richard Grinnell, refuted the claims. NPR's Elizabeth Blair has more.
Senator Sheldon Whitehouse claims that current Kennedy Center leadership is responsible for, quote, millions in lost revenue, luxury spending, and preferential treatment for Trump allies. Documents posted on a Senate committee website appear to support those claims, including letting the soccer organization FIFA take over the center for 3 weeks rent-free. In a letter, Whitehouse asked Kennedy Center President Richard Grenell to turn over documents related to the center's financial management, expenditures, donors, and contacts by December 4th. Grenell wrote back to White House saying his letter is filled with partisan attacks and false accusations. The letter is posted to the Kennedy Center's social media. Elizabeth Blair, NPR News, Washington.
Pope Leo XIV has revealed he uses a different Wordle start word each day. He divulged his strategy playing the popular New York Times online game during an online encounter with American young people. I'm Ryland Barton. You're listening to NPR News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Kresge Foundation with Pathbreakers, a podcast about transforming communities through innovation, from revolutionizing higher education to supporting artists who are driving change. Pathbreakers is available on podcast platforms.
It is 6 minutes past the hour, and you're listening to All Things Considered here on KAXE KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingel. We receive support from AW Research Laboratories, located in Brainerd, providing water testing for private wells, real estate, lakes, and wastewater since 1972. Online at awlab.com. And coming up at 5:30, it's going to be the Up North Report from our KAXE KBXE news team. Now back to All Things Considered.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow.
And I'm Juana Summers. New polling from NPR says Americans are largely unhappy with how things are going in the country. President Trump gets bad marks, as does his Republican Party, but so do Democrats. NPR senior national political correspondent Mara Liasson and senior political editor and correspondent Domenico Montanaro talked about all of this with NPR Politics podcast co-host Miles Parks.
Domenico, what do you see in this new NPR PBS News Marist poll?
Well, it was a pretty eye-opening poll, I thought, this week. You know, Democrats are up 14 points in what's known as the congressional ballot test. We ask routinely, you know, if elections were held today, who would you vote for in your district, a Republican or a Democrat? 55% in this poll said a Democrat, 41% said a Republican. In Marist polls, that's the biggest lead that we've seen since 2017, since Trump's first administration. And I have to say, in 20 years of covering politics, I can't remember seeing a good survey put out a congressional ballot where one party is at 55 in the congressional ballot. Look, this could be an outlier, but there's plenty of evidence that it's not, especially with the elections earlier this month, where, you know, Democrats did well up and down the ballot, and voters seem to be upset with Trump and Republicans, especially on the issue of affordability.
14 points is a lot of points. It sounds like the makings of a blowup, but we are still a year away from midterms.
Sure, we're still a year away, but I do think that if Democrats can maintain a lead of anywhere from, 8 to 11 points advantage in the generic ballot, that's setting them up for a very good midterm. So things have changed, and the predictive power of these polls and the generic ballot question has really dropped. Why? Because there are so fewer truly competitive seats. We have more Democrats sitting in seats that Trump won than Republicans sitting in seats that Harris won. And also, Republicans have an advantage, not even counting the mid-cycle gerrymandering that's going on in states like Texas and California.
Yeah, I was going to say the gerrymandering has really led to a right-leaning number of seats in the country that are, you know, seemingly a majority, and that's why Democrats need to have a bigger advantage on this question.
Well, thinking ahead to how Republicans respond to all of this, the first thing that they did after this government shutdown, Domenico, was to vote to force President Trump's Department of Justice to release files related to Jeffrey Epstein. Mm-hmm. Where does the party stand, or how are they thinking about moving forward over the next year?
Yeah, I mean, I think it'd be too far to say that the party's fracturing and people are breaking away from Trump, but it's certainly easier to do that when a president has low approval ratings, as Trump does. I mean, our poll had him at 39% job approval, the lowest since just after January 6th. It was 24% with independents. He's on the wrong side of a lot of issues, the economy, people thinking he's going too far on how the administration is conducting deportations. But I have to say, you know, I'm skeptical that there will be that much change where we see Republicans suddenly abandoning the president, because he's still very popular with base Republican voters. In our survey, 9 in 10 Republicans still approve of the job he's doing.
And what's just a little caveat about the unpopularity of Democrats, they are unpopular, historically unpopular, but a lot of the people who say they are not happy with Democrats are Democratic voters. They're not happy with Democrats. Does that mean they're going to vote for Republicans? No. Are they going to stay home? Probably not, because these voters are very, very angry. And we saw in the off years that they are motivated. Whether Trump is on the ballot or not, they are motivated.
I mean, the thing I struggle with, Domenico, is just trying to figure out what matters right now, because it does feel like there's a new political controversy, scandal, something big happening every single day. And I get the sense that that advantages Trump, that nothing ever really seems to stick.
Well, yeah, I mean, Trump is chaos. You know, that's always been his strategy. That's been his playbook. You know, he puts out a fire hose of stuff, you know, controversial things online, as we saw even this week. I think the difference here is that Trump and Republicans, like Democrats and President Biden before him, can't escape the fact that people are feeling a pinch in their pockets. You know, it's arguably one of, the reason why he won crossover voters in the 2024 presidential election. Still, the main issue in our poll, 57% said that lowering prices needs to be Trump's top priority. Immigration was a distant second at 16%, despite the fact that Trump continues to say, or has said repeatedly in the second term, that immigration is really the most important issue. But even a plurality of Republicans were saying that lowering prices is the top priority. So they are screaming it out in the surveys and at the ballot box.
The economy, and particularly prices, is a different kind of issue. It's easy to change the subject from a lot of issues, but not when people feel they are being pinched and prices are going up for their basic goods like food and rent and education. And it's very hard to convince people that the economy is better than they feel. And if presidents try, Biden tried, Trump is trying now, try to convince them that something is different than they're feeling, they are insulted.
Well, I do feel like a lot can change in a year, specifically, and maybe most importantly, it sounds like, on the economy. How much can we really learn from a poll like this, Domenico, this far out from midterms?
Yeah, I mean, I think it offers a lot of value. I mean, it offers a good framework for where we are right now, you know, what the mood of the country is, what the reporting lines, frankly, will be heading into the next year. What is it that voters care most about? We know what people think is most important. We see this as really a critical juncture of Trump's presidency, because he's inching closer to that lame duck status, and certainly would be if Democrats take back the House next year. But Democrats have to worry about peaking too soon. They're not taking Republicans by surprise on the issue of affordability. There are some real warning signs for Democrats in this survey as well. As Mara said, Democrats don't really like the people in their own party. And the bottom line here is, if prices stay what they are, it's advantage Democrats. But if they come down and people feel improvements, then this lead very much could recede.
Right. That means Trump has to deliver. He can't just convince people the economy is better than they think it is. He has to actually bring prices down.
You can find more on the political news of the day on the NPR Politics podcast. It's on the NPR app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Earlier this week at the Sotheby's art auction in New York, a portrait painted by Gustav Klimt sold for a record-breaking price.
The Klimt Julian is yours. Congratulations.
Fees included, the painting cost an anonymous bidder $236.4 million, which makes it the most expensive work of modern art ever sold at auction. Beneath the price tag, the painting called Portrait of Elizabeth Lederer has a heroic backstory. To hear more about it, we are joined by Wagner College art history professor Laura Morawitz. Welcome to All Things Considered.
Thank you so much. My pleasure.
I want to get into the backstory in a moment, but let's just start with the artist, Gustav Klimt, for people who don't hang modern art in their dorm rooms, which I think is actually a large chunk of our listenership. What should they know about his work and his overall place in the art world?
Gustav Klimt is probably the most important turn of the century Viennese artist. He was really a maverick in his own day. Klimt is a kind of bridge between the 19th and the 20th century. And although he wasn't particularly popular in the United States until about the 1960s, he has become really, I think, one of the most sought out and iconic artists. Many, many people will be familiar with his golden period, works like The Kiss, and many of the portraits which are hanging in museums all around the world.
And the painting just sold, Portrait of Elizabeth Lederer. Just the art itself, what is the value and the importance of this work?
Well, the work is not only a beautiful representation of a work from Klim Slater, period. It was done between 1914 and 1916, and Klimt will die in 1918. He will have a stroke, so it belongs to the later period of Klimt's work. But as a document of history, it's also very, very fascinating.
Yeah.
The backstory is pretty remarkable. Elisabeth Lederer, who was the daughter of Auguste and Serena Lederer, were the most important collectors mm-hmm. of Gustav Klimt's work. That alone would be significant and would place the work in a really special category.
But this goes beyond that, because it's not an exaggeration to say that this painting helped save somebody's life?
It's actually quite accurate to say that. Elisabeth had been married actually to a Nazi. He was not a very good husband either, and he divorced Elisabeth in 1934. So she was left extremely vulnerable. And when the Nazis marched in and annexed Austria during the Anschluss in 1938, she was really in a very, very dangerous situation. As we know, if you were Jewish in Vienna in this period, you were very, very likely to be deported.
Mm-hmm.
And she did something extremely clever, and it did save her life. She got her mother to sign a affidavit saying, in fact, that she was the daughter not of her actual father, August Lederer, but rather the product of an affair with Gustav Klimt. This rendered her what the Nazis called a Mischling, or a part Jew. She was therefore able to stay in Vienna, and this essentially probably saved her life.
So I want to come back to the price tag, though. $236 million. Did that surprise you?
You know, it's really hard to say. It's so foreign and abstract for me. Most art historians and researchers are usually not the people who are purchasing art. And so,
you don't have a $236 million.
I don't even have a $2 million painting. So, you know, to me, when you get above $100 million, it's also abstract anyway. I guess I'm not totally surprised to the extent that the monetary value of Klimt's works mm-hmm. have been rising. And because this particular work really is astonishingly important. It's beautiful. You know, if you look at the portrait, she looks so vulnerable, and she has these beautiful sort of dark black eyes and is standing surrounded by these light colors and these jade greens and purples. So it's beautiful. And then it has this remarkable history of being part of this collection from this noted family of collectors, and then, you know, also becoming this linchpin in the story of this woman's life.
Mm-hmm.
So to that extent, I guess I'm not surprised, but I really don't know what it means when works go to that level. I don't know how you could put any price tag on something so valuable like that.
That's Laura Marowitz, an art history professor at Wagner College. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
It is 18 minutes past the hour, and you're listening to All Things Considered here on KAXE KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. Coming up at 5:30, it's going to be the Up North Report from our KAXE KBXE news team. We receive support from the Watermark Art Center in downtown Bemidji with exhibits, classes, and handcrafted original art made by regional artists. Found in their shop 505. The center is accessible and open to the public. WatermarkArtCenter.org. KAXE has been chosen for Newsmatch 2025. It's a national campaign supporting local nonprofit newsrooms like ours. You helped us get here, and now your gift can go even further. We have over $45,000 in matching funds to support strong local journalism across northern Minnesota. Your gift of up to $1,000 will now be matched 4-1. While matching funds remain. The campaign runs through the end of the year. Give now at KAXE.org. Thank you for supporting people-powered KAXE. Programming on KAXE KBXE is supported in part by MinSure, offering Minnesotans the opportunity to find discounts, compare private health plans, and see if they qualify for no-cost or low-cost insurance. Expert advice is also available. The enrollment deadline is December 18th for coverage starting January 1st. Information and enrollment are online at mnsure.org. My Neighbor to Love Coalition in Brainerd is working to end homelessness for 30 neighbors this December. Construction is nearly complete on 19 units at Creekside Community, but funds are needed to purchase basic household furnishings. Learn more at mntlc.org/donate. The mountain bike trails at Tioga Recreation Area near Cohasset are closed now through November 23rd due to deer hunting. Now we'll take you back to All Things Considered here on KAXE KBXE.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Odoo, maker of business management software with the goal of promoting growth and scaling businesses with efficiency. Learn more about Odoo at odoo.com. And from The Economist, in a world of rapid change, The Economist seeks to cut through the noise to offer insight into what matters now and what's coming next. Daily global reporting, podcasts, and videos at economist.com/NPR. This is NPR.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow.
And I'm Juana Summers. The state of North Carolina borders no other countries. Its biggest city, Charlotte, is about 200 miles inland from the Atlantic Ocean. But agents who led the federal immigration enforcement campaign that started last weekend in Charlotte were from the U.S. Border Patrol. Yesterday, the mayor and sheriff said the Border Patrol had left town. Hours later, the Department of Homeland Security said the operation in Charlotte isn't ending anytime soon. So why is the Border Patrol the face of the Trump administration's aggressive mass deportation initiative in Charlotte and in other major cities, as opposed to ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement? Atlantic staff writer Nick Miroff has investigated this and joins us now. Hi there.
Hey, Juana.
So, Nick, to be clear, Border Patrol and ICE, they both conduct federal law enforcement under the Department of Homeland Security. Help us understand what the difference is.
Yeah, I mean, they're both part of the Department of Homeland Security, but until now have had a pretty clear division of labor, and that is that the Border Patrol is responsible for protecting the country's borders and looking for threats that may be trying to enter, whether that be people crossing illegally or narcotics or something like that. And ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, is really responsible for immigration enforcement in the interior of the United States, away from the border areas. And typically that has consisted of ensuring compliance with things like immigration court orders and orders to depart the country for those who have exhausted their illegal appeals to remain in the United States.
And you've written that Border Patrol and ICE, they operate differently. Can you explain how, like, are the tactics different? Is one more aggressive than the other?
Yeah, I mean, it's really a very different mentality. Your typical Border Patrol agent is doing, what is referred to as area control. And that means they're looking for anyone coming into their area, and they're seeing them as a potential suspect who they need to go and question. And, their biggest responsibility is making sure that nobody sneaks past them. They're worried about someone who could be doing harm, someone with who's a serious criminal or a drug smuggler. Whereas the way that ICE has typically conducted immigration enforcement in U.S. cities and communities is what they call targeted enforcement. That means they do some research, they know who they're looking for, they have a picture of that person, they know their address, and they plan their operation, and then they go out and execute it. The problem with that approach is that it doesn't deliver the extraordinary numbers that the White House and the president are demanding, and that is, a million deportations a year. Right. And because ICE wasn't getting those numbers, President Trump and the Department of Homeland Security have been bringing the Border Patrol in to try to help.
And how does what we see the Border Patrol doing here, how does that differ from their typical duties? This is not normally what Border Patrol does.
Yeah, no administration has ever used the Border Patrol in this way, deploying them on this scale in U.S. cities and communities. They say that they've got more than 2,000 agents right now in 25 cities. And really, the face of the president's mass deportation campaign has ceased to be, border czar Tom Homan, who's a former ICE official, and it's really now become Border Patrol Commander Greg Bovino. He's the one that has been leading the most aggressive operations, first Los Angeles, then Chicago, and now most recently in Charlotte and elsewhere in North Carolina. And, that approach is clearly what the White House wants, and it's been defined by a more confrontational, more aggressive, and really less discriminate form of carrying out, you know, these operations.
Tell us a little bit more about Gregory Bovino. As you note, he's been the figurehead in a number of these operations, including there in Charlotte. What's his role?
Well, Greg Bovino is a career Border Patrol official. He was the top official in the El Centro sector of California's Imperial Valley. So he really distinguished himself within the Border Patrol for his teams producing very kind of edgy social media videos that, you know, really were designed both, I think, to boost recruiting, but also to promote the image of the Border Patrol as this kind of paramilitary organization that was, you know, going out and fighting the Mexican cartels and that sort of thing. And he really got the White House's attention with his knack for this kind of social media approach, but also his willingness to go out and really hit the streets and kind of, you know, operate in as aggressive a way as possible.
You wrote, and I'm quoting here, Trump has turned Bovino's agents into a personal army as well as a political tool. And that stuck out to me because President Trump has mused, we've heard him muse about sending active duty military into U.S. cities. And if he did that, he would likely face a whole lot of legal challenges. Do you think that using Border Patrol in this way is sort of a loophole?
You know, I think the Border Patrol for the president and the White House is kind of the next best thing to a military deployment. Trump has mused openly about using, you know, active duty troops and the Marines, and he's been trying to send National Guard troops into U.S. cities. He's faced various kind of legal setbacks to doing that. And their forces, especially their tactical forces that Bovino is traveling with, you know, they wear camouflage, they have big guns, they wear ballistic helmets and armor, and really they look like, you know, soldiers. And probably the best example of that is in Chicago when they flew a Black Hawk helicopter over the south side of Chicago and rappelled down onto an apartment building in the middle of the night to arrest a few dozen immigrants, including primarily Venezuelan families. But more than 6 weeks later, they have not produced any evidence of narcotics or weapons that supposedly made these folks so dangerous.
I think a big question on a lot of people's minds is just simply, is it legal to deploy the Border Patrol in this manner?
It is, in that the Border Patrol has the kind of broad authority to enforce immigration laws inside the United States wherever they need to go. There were lawsuits early on when Bovino's teams first went to Los Angeles and were, you know, advocates developed a record of them conducting racial profiling on the streets of Los Angeles and brought a lawsuit. And they successfully appealed it all the way to the Supreme Court. And that's when we got the opinion from Justice Brett Kavanaugh, really kind of affirming their ability to use the ethnic appearance of someone, their, you know, whether they speak Spanish, in terms of reaching a reasonable suspicion that person might be in the country illegally. And that's been kind of a green light for them to fan out across the United States and conduct the operations we see in this kind of way.
We've reached out to the Department of Homeland Security for comment on your story, but I'm curious, what did they tell you when you reached out to them to confirm the details of your reporting for The Atlantic?
They really wanted to insist that the Department of Homeland Security is one team, and to really kind of play down some of the emerging tensions over this Border Patrol deployment and the Border Patrol's kind of prominence in superseding ICE.
It's been widely reported that the Border Patrol is preparing for an operation in New Orleans next. So has this sort of become their MO, going from one major city to another major city to continue to conduct these operations?
It certainly appears that way, and that's the way that Bovino describes it. It's almost become a kind of, you know, traveling roadshow. What we saw in Charlotte were, you know, reports of school children remaining home and, you know, churches empty and, you know, stores empty, that type of thing. It really has a broad chilling effect, but I think it's worth pointing out that that is partly what they're going for. I mean, this administration is leaning heavily into the idea that if it's tough enough and if it can intimidate enough people, that they will self-deport. And that's how they will manage to reach the kind of ambitious, you know, deportation goals that Trump has set.
Nick Miroff of The Atlantic, thank you so much.
Thank you, Juana. Anytime.
And just to note, we have not received a response from the Department of Homeland Security about Nick Miroff's reporting.
This is NPR News.
It is 529, and you're listening to All Things Considered here on KAXE KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. Coming up next is the Up North Report. We receive support from Paul Bunyan Communications, powered by the Gigazone, a broadband cooperative featuring all fiber optic GigaZone internet speeds up to 10 gig and local customer service. Learn more at paulbunyan.net. Now it's time for the Up North Report here on KAXE KBXE, Pima Powered Radio.
For KAXE News, I'm Megan Buffington with the Up North Report. Authorities are investigating a Wednesday night fire at a Staples apartment complex. A news release from the Staples Fire Department says responders were dispatched around 9:30 p.m. for an activated smoke detector and general fire alarm at the high-rise apartments. Firefighters were advised there was smoke on the second floor of the 60-unit complex. They located a person in the second floor apartment where the fire started. They were eventually airlifted to a metro hospital. The fire was contained in a single unit, but several tenants were displaced due to minor smoke damage. They are receiving services from the Red Cross. The Minnesota Bureau of Criminal Apprehension identified the man shot and killed and the deputies involved in a deadly exchange of gunfire in Onegum on Sunday. The BCA confirmed 37-year-old James Weyes of Onegum was killed. The Minnesota Star Tribune reported he was the former foster son of Leech Lake Tribal Chairman Farron Jackson. The agency's initial investigation found Cass County deputies were called Sunday afternoon on a report of shots fired. While responding, they passed Weyes walking alone on a nearby road. According to the BCA, Deputy Caleb Churn attempted to speak with Weyes, but he ran from him. Churn pursued him on foot. The two exchanged gunfire, and Churn was struck in the right thigh. He was airlifted to a Fargo hospital and has since been released. Deputy David Donner was responding to the foot chase when he saw Weyes emerge onto the road. Donner shot Weyes, who was pronounced dead at the scene. Donner and Churn are on critical incident leave. The BCA will continue its investigation and then present its findings to the Cass County Attorney's Office for further review. A petition is circulating to force a vote by the public on whether a consolidation between the Renshaw and neighboring Carlton school districts moves forward. The Cloquet Pine Journal reports that with the signatures of 5% of eligible voters in the Renshaw School District, the petition could trigger a special election. That would determine whether the schools would consolidate versus leaving it in the hands of the elected school boards. The topic of consolidation in the area is not new, but the Pine Journal reports the school boards finally voted for consolidation in October and plan to have a second vote in January. The boards want to consolidate by next June. Shelley Raskovich and Barb Carnes hadn't been to the Nashwauk High School since they graduated in 1972. Carnes lives in Grand Rapids, but Raskovich drove all the way from Duluth to visit the school one last time Friday with their classmates Wendy Grease and Carolyn Johnson.
Yeah, wow. So we have to do a walkthrough, one final.
Yeah.
Walk through and see who we remember, the classes, yeah. The teachers, the kids.
Yes.
The kids who are no longer
and
kids.
Things that have changed since we were here.
Yeah, you know? Definitely have changed.
The Nashwauk-Keewatin School District hosted a liquidation sale, selling off chairs, doors, books, whatever was left in the century-old building. People were lined up at the doors before the sale began, and over 200 people had been through with 2 hours to go. The district moved into its new pre-K through 12 building this fall, and the historic Nashwauk High School and Keewatin Elementary are slated for demolition in the coming weeks.
You know, it's sad. It is sad to see it go. You know, I'd like to see it fixed. You know, repurposed for something.
A historic mosaic from the library has already been removed and will be going up in the new school next year. Walking the halls brought up a lot of memories for the girlfriends from 72. Coming up with excuses so they didn't have to swim in gym class, climbing out the windows onto the lawn, a mean math teacher, and school lunch thieves.
And so, to get even, two people put cat food on their sandwiches. So if you're going to steal their lunches, they got cat food.
Alumni and school board members Barb Colmy and Don Warwis shared memories of the school too, like watching games from the gym balcony.
You know, that's how we students got, if you weren't sitting in the bleachers underneath, you hung over the top of the rail.
It wasn't much for bleachers, it was just a little bit. Yeah. You were right in the game.
Another liquidation sale is planned for Keewatin Elementary on December 5th, but Colmy says asbestos abatement has already started there, which may lead to that sale being canceled. That's it for the Up North Report. From the KAXE News Desk, I'm Megan Buffington, telling the stories of northern Minnesota through local news.
The Up North Report on KAXE is sponsored by Woodland Bank.
dedicated to serving local businesses, families, and nonprofits in our area since 1920. You can find more information online at woodland.bank.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Drexel University, whose cooperative education program positions students to explore future careers before graduation. This is experiential education. More at drexel.edu. From Easy Cater, designed to help organizations order food for meetings and events from a nationwide network of restaurants, create lunch programs for their employees, and manage food spend at easycater.com. And from the Doris Duke Foundation.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Scott Detrow. Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky is suggesting that his country's relationship with its single most important ally, the United States, is at risk. This after the release of another Kremlin-friendly plan put forward by the Trump administration in an attempt to end Russia's war on Ukraine. Zelensky made the comments in a video address as he faces pressure from the Trump administration to sign on to the plan by Thanksgiving. Zelensky told Ukrainians that their country is under immense pressure and facing a very difficult choice, a loss of dignity or the risk of losing a key partner as it defends itself from Russia. Joining us now to discuss the latest developments in is NPR's Ukraine correspondent, Joanna Kakissis. Hey, Joanna.
Hey, Scott.
I mean, this sounds like quite the speech from Zelensky. What more can you tell us about it?
Well, Zelensky spoke today as part of Ukraine's Dignity and Freedom Day, which honors those who have died trying to preserve Ukraine's independence and sovereignty. This is a day that's hugely symbolic after nearly 4 years of Russia's full-scale war. Now, Zelensky seemed to sense the significance of this moment because his country is once again under pressure by the Trump administration. Now, in this speech, Zelensky did not specifically name the U.S. as the key partner Ukraine was at risk of losing. However, he did meet this week with a military delegation from the U.S. in an effort to restart peace talks. And he was presented with this 28-point proposal to end the war, one drafted by Trump's Middle East envoy Steve Witkoff and Kremlin advisor Kirill Dmitriev. Instead of going through the proposal point by point, Zelensky talked about what his focus would be in the coming days. He's saying he will present arguments and offer alternatives, but that he will not give the Kremlin reasons to say Ukraine does not want peace or is not ready for diplomacy.
What exactly in this plan is so controversial?
So before I get into that, I should say a U.S. official told NPR's Tom Bowman that Army Secretary Dan Driscoll insisted to European ambassadors that the document will change as part of the collaborative process. However, Ukraine sees the proposal in its current form as a recipe for Ukrainian capitulation because it offers Russia far more than was discussed in previous negotiations to end this war. Like, demands include Ukraine surrendering territory, cutting its military, giving up some long-range weapons and dropping its bid to join the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. Now, the proposal does appear to give Ukraine security guarantees to protect itself from Russia, but Ukraine and its European allies say Russia does not stick to deals. Zelensky said in his speech that European leaders see Russia as a threat. He's saying that Ukrainians must do everything to ensure that when this war ends, Ukraine and Europe do not end with it.
Now, Joanna, Zelensky has made similar warnings before. You have covered them. Does this one feel more urgent now?
Yes, and that's for a number of reasons. Zelensky is facing a huge political crisis at home with this energy corruption scandal that has implicated his close associates. Ukrainians are facing blackouts as Russia repeatedly hits the country's energy grid. And Ukrainian forces are facing more pressure on the front line as Russian troops have infiltrated a key city in eastern Ukraine.
What's the Kremlin saying about this?
Well, actually, Russian President Vladimir Putin spoke about the proposal tonight, confirming that he'd seen it. He told a Russian Security Council meeting in Moscow that this proposal is a modernized version of a plan he discussed with Trump at a summit in Alaska this summer. Now, Putin says he believes this plan can be used as a basis for a final peaceful settlement, though he added that there has not been much discussion in Russia about this because he said the U.S. had yet to convince Ukraine to accept this deal.
That's NPR Ukraine correspondent Joanna Kakissis. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
It seems like every week there's a main character, someone or something that the internet just becomes obsessed with. All Things Considered producer Mia Venkat explains what that was this week. Hey.
Hi, Juana.
All right, Mia, what is it?
So the main character this week is the children's face mask from the brand Rini.
Okay, you got to catch me up because I have never heard of this brand.
All right, so Rini is a skincare brand whose products are marketed to kids as young as four. Actress Shay Mitchell, you might know her from the show Pretty Little Liars, yep. Co-founded the brand, and it launched 2 weeks ago with a sheet mask line. So, Juana, I'm going to show you a picture, and I want you to tell me what you see and how it makes you feel.
I do not like this. Okay, this is a picture of a child, probably under the age of five, if I had to guess, with a see-through sheet mask. They do not look happy to be wearing this. I would not be either.
Right, it's a very stoic look. So that is Shay Mitchell's daughter, Atlas, and she's 6 years old. And so, just like your reaction, there has been a ton of backlash to this launch and the marketing. And the backlash is in two parts. One part is it really safe for kids? Mm-hmm. Do kids even need this? But the other part is more psychological. Most of the comments that I saw were about how this feels really dystopian. Something about seeing a kid wearing a skincare sheet mask feels icky. TikTok creator Santa Banana made a video about it, and here's part of her take.
I really thought that children were off limits in terms of the marketing and greed of the beauty industry, but apparently not. Nothing is off limits, and that's how you know we've entered late-stage capitalist hell.
So the other thing that this creator and others have mentioned is the potential risk to young girls exposing them to the beauty industry like this so early. And to be fair to Rini, the sheet masks aren't exclusively marketed to girls. There are some boys on their website. But the larger discourse from folks touches on how there's already a lot of pressure on girls specifically to meet unrealistic beauty standards, and like, we don't need to jumpstart this at age four.
Absolutely not. Also, why does a four-year-old need a sheet mask? Like, I get it. I am old. I am tired. I didn't sleep last night. I know why I need one. This is confusing to me.
So Rini's website says these products are about playing. And in response to the criticism, co-founder Shay Mitchell told the Today Show this week that she was surprised by the backlash, but understands when people get skeptical when anything has to do with kids. But she explained where this idea started.
This came from my experience from being a mom, having two girls myself, and seeing that there wasn't anything out there I felt safe enough putting on their skin when they wanted to share in on this moment that I do.
And a lot of people online have agreed with Mitchell's point. Like, kids do want to do grown-up stuff and join in on whatever mom's doing. And this is a safe way for them to play and join in. Personally, Juana, there's probably 100 pictures of me wearing my mom's heels with lipstick streaked across my face.
Yeah, I think there's probably some of those out there of me, too. And if my mom is listening to this, I hope that she keeps those locked away and off the internet. Setting that aside for a second, there are concerns about marketing to kids specifically, of course, and you mentioned safety. What do we know about the safety of this product?
So the company says the product is dermatologist-tested and extremely safe for kids. But critics are saying just because it's safe for kids doesn't mean kids should be using it. Dr. Fatima Fahas is a dermatologist, and she made a video about this on Instagram.
The only thing your kid's skin needs is the following: gentle cleanser, a gentle moisturizer, and a broad spectrum sunscreen with an SPF of 30 or above. They should not be applying masks. They should not be building a skincare routine, especially at these young ages. They should be playing.
I mean, they're 4 and 5 year olds. Of course they should be playing.
Yeah, and the fact that the reaction is the main character this week, it seems like a lot of the internet agrees.
NPR's Mia Venkat, thank you.
Thank you, Juana.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. People walking through New York's Times Square recently may have noticed that among the many electronic billboards are images of a beach, blue water, and the caption, Miami Beach is open for business. The ads are being paid for by a Florida developer who believes the recent election of a Democratic Socialist mayor in New York City is an opportunity to lure wealthy residents and their businesses south. NPR's Greg Allen reports from Miami Beach.
On the white sand of Miami Beach, people sunbathe and swim while gulls gather along the shoreline. Russell Galbert, one of Miami Beach's biggest developers, paid for the electronic ads featuring that image, which began running recently in Times Square. One impetus for the billboards, he says, was the recent election of Democratic Socialist Zoran Mamdani as mayor of New York.
It just made it a good time, in my view. We have yet to see how the new mayor is going to do. But there's no question that there's a lot of surprise and shock on many people.
Galbert is funding the ad campaign himself. It builds on messaging Miami Beach Mayor Stephen Miner started on social media days after the New York election.
Really, we're just highlighting, hey, if you're looking for a law and order city with sunshine, with no state income tax, there's a lot of positives for why you should be here.
Miner says Miami Beach wants to welcome New Yorkers who are unhappy with the election results.
The mayor-elect is a self-described socialist, and I think there's a concern about the freedom of businesses to act as capitalist businesses need to. But there's also a concern by Jewish residents and businesses.
Mamdani alarmed some Jewish voters because of his support for Palestinian rights and critical views of Israel. Exit polls showed Mamdani received about a third of the Jewish vote in this month's election. Galbert says he decided to fund an ad campaign because of his frustration at what he views as economic stagnation at one of Florida's most popular resort destinations. After years of violence during spring break, including some shootings, Miami Beach adopted tough measures 2 years ago that have been effective. But the developer says a decline in sales tax revenue and business closures since then shows something else is needed.
Miami Beach went into an entire campaign to tell people that we didn't want spring breakers in Miami Beach any longer. But we never spent 5 cents or $5 on a campaign saying who we do want.
Mayor Miner is more upbeat about the business climate in Miami Beach and says a $30 million revitalization project is underway to boost the city's business district.
We have Lamborghini is opening up a showroom in Miami Beach. A Swiss watchmaker is coming here. So there's a lot of investment coming here. We're just highlighting for people who maybe hadn't thought of Miami Beach, that they should be.
Miner says he's had mostly positive comments, but has gotten pushback on social media from residents who worry newcomers will just make traffic worse. In Miami Beach, an informal survey found mostly support for a campaign to bring more New Yorkers to the city.
Well, having come from New York, I wouldn't mind a few more.
Neil Kahanovitz is a retiree who left New York years ago.
I got tired of the cold, the crowds, the crime, and the high taxes.
And the idea that you have a Democratic Socialist who was elected, and they're saying that might encourage more people to leave. Do you think that would?
It's certainly not going to encourage them to stay.
Michael Sprotzer, another Miami Beach resident, is skeptical that a wave of New Yorkers and their businesses will soon be heading south.
I mean, I think maybe some people who were thinking about coming to South Florida, it'll be like a good impetus for them to do so, but I don't think people who love New York are going to all of a sudden move down here, so.
Sprotzer, who works in real estate, notes that some of the investment firms who during COVID moved their offices to South Florida have since moved back to New York. Greg Allen, NPR News, Miami Beach.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
It is 5:48, and you're listening to All Things Considered here on KAXE KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. We receive support from Bemidji Brewing, embracing the cooler weather with the release of several seasonal beers this November, including the Winter IPA, Holiday Ale, and Icebox Dark Lager. Bemidji Beer, nice catch. The city of Virginia has a Twilight Holiday Parade tomorrow, beginning at 5:15 on Chestnut Street and Fifth Avenue. Fireworks follow on the shore of Silver Lake. There's another tailgate pantry happening in Bemidji November 23rd from 2 to 4 in the Farmers Market parking lot downtown. Bring, swap, or take food and hygiene items. We receive support from ICTV. Stay tuned, stay connected with ICTV. Learn more at watchictv.org. The Friends of the Grand Rapids Area Library will hold a holiday book boutique Monday, November 24th from 10 to 6 at the library, featuring books of all kinds, plus puzzles and games. Kotaska Community Action offers a free lunch every Wednesday from 11 to 1 at their Circles of Support office, located across from Treasure Bay Printing on Northeast 4th Street in Grand Rapids. They also offer a food pantry from 11 to 2, Monday through Thursday. Floodwood Business Community Partnership offers a Christmas shopping night Monday, November 24th from 3 to 7 at the Floodwood Fair Center and local businesses. Visit with Santa from 5 to 6:30 at the Events Center. Great River Rescue in Bemidji is looking for donations for their upcoming online auction, which begins December 8th. Items like art, themed baskets, or gift cards may be dropped off Saturdays in November from 11 to 4. And there's a health fair at the Itasca County Family YMCA in Grand Rapids, Monday, November 24th from 2 to 5. Several free screenings will be offered, including bone density and glucose testing.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Scott Detrow. The wildly popular online gaming platform Roblox has started rolling out facial age verification to enhance its security measures. The move follows a string of lawsuits alleging the platform has allowed predators to groom and sexually abuse children. Of the game's 80 million daily players, 40% are under the age of 13. So how effective is this measure, and what can parents do to protect children from online abuse? We are joined now by Justin Patchen. He's a professor of criminal justice at the University of Wisconsin-Eau Claire and has studied child internet safety for decades. Welcome to All Things Considered.
I'm happy to be with you, Scott. Thank you.
Let's start out with this for people who do not have preteens in their lives. What's a quick overview of what Roblox is, why it's such a big deal?
Well, Roblox is an online gaming platform, basically. It's an app that you can connect to that's got literally millions of games or experiences. And I think that's part of the problem is there's so many different experiences on the platform, and it's hard to regulate all of them. So people, users can create their own games. They can play games created by others. They can interact with people all over the world. And some research from last year found that upwards of 80% of 9 to 12-year-olds have used Roblox.
And the other context I wanted to get through before we get into the steps Roblox is taking is there really something specific about Roblox that makes this a place that so many predators are focused, or is it just the fact that this is a big way station for so many younger kids to be using the internet?
I think it's a couple of things. It is super popular right now, especially among that younger demographic. And so whenever you have, you know, kids just flocking to an environment like this, it's certainly going to attract the bad actors. So I also think it's become very popular very quick. And so I know Roblox is trying to do everything they can to ensure safety and to protect kids, but it's just blown up in popularity. So it's hard for Roblox to keep up.
Yeah. Specifically, these new measures include requiring facial verification for players. Roblox says this will enable the platform to limit player interactions to the same age group. What do you make of that?
It's an interesting idea. You know, as a researcher, I'm very curious to see how it'll work. And so I hope there's some efforts to evaluate its effectiveness of, you know, of sort of age grouping these children.
I mean, so much of this feels like lose, lose, lose for parents, right? I've got kids who are not quite Roblox age, but the idea of facial scanning makes me uncomfortable. Obviously, the idea of being in a place where there are bad actors makes me uncomfortable. And the idea of saying, no, you can't use this platform that so many other kids are using also feels like not the right move. Like, how do you suggest parents try to navigate this?
It's true. It does seem like a big challenge for parents. It is a popular place. And to be honest, the vast majority of the games and experiences are perfectly fine. The vast majority of kids who use Roblox do just fine and aren't targeted by predators. And I think as a parent, we just need to be aware of these issues. Certainly when our kids are first exploring Roblox or any social media platform, gaming platform, we need to be a part of that experience. We need to go on the app with them. We need to better understand what your kids are doing, who they're interacting with. And when they're first starting out, it's actually pretty easy to block certain experiences, to restrict access to communication tools, meaning people aren't able to chat with them or message them. And so I think early on, especially limiting, you know, the game experience to the people you know and trust family members, for example, and then sort of easing into more experience as they gain more kind of awareness of the potential for problems on these apps. So the big thing is parents need to be a part of the solution and a part of the experience early on.
That's Justin Patchen, a professor of criminal justice at the University of Wisconsin-Eau Claire. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Starting next month, the U.S. Coast Guard planned to refer the use of racist symbols like swastikas and nooses as potentially divisive instead of continuing their policy of identifying them as hate symbols. Since the Washington Post and other outlets reported that news on Thursday, there's been an uproar, and the Coast Guard has walked back some of those proposed changes. Steve Walsh joins us now from member station WHRO in Norfolk, Virginia, to explain. Hi.
Hi, Juana.
So, Steve, there's been a whole lot of outrage about this, but how did this come about? Like, what was the initial policy on language?
So it's an update of the Coast Guard's manual for handling harassment, including how cases are investigated. Previous manuals used the term hate symbols to describe swastikas, nooses, the Confederate flag, or other symbols associated with racial and religious supremacist movements. But the Coast Guard wanted to change that. Instead, what was previously called hate incidents was now being lumped in with other harassment claims. The policy was set to take effect December 15, but after reports of the new language went public, Jewish groups and several lawmakers rang alarm bells. So late Thursday night, the Coast Guard released another policy. In the newer language, the Coast Guard emphasized its, quote, commitment to prohibiting divisive or hate symbols and flags. So the word hate was back in the description.
So Coast Guard officials still maintain that instances of things like swastikas displayed on a ship, for example, or in the barracks will still be investigated, right?
Right. You know, and that's not wrong. But, you know, the new manual still lumps these cases in with other types of harassment claims. Now, the old policy went much farther and defined the process for investigating instances of hate. It specifically stated that not every hate incident could be classified as harassment, which typically means targeting a single person, when, as we know, displaying a white supremacist symbol in a common area targets an entire group of people. And Juana, it's important to point out that many of these provisions were either put in place or strengthened under the first Trump administration. So the overall tone of the previous policy was more emphatic, setting tough deadlines to begin investigations and requiring problems be reported up the chain of command to an admiral. The new manual also covers sexual harassment, and it emphasizes mediation for what it calls low-level claims, and references to transgender Coast Guardsmen were eliminated entirely.
Do you know if there were specific incidents that the old policy was trying to address?
Sure. I mean, the military says this is rare, but in 2021 and in 2023, sailors on board two separate Navy ships found nooses tied over their bunks. There was a 2007 incident involving a noose at the Coast Guard Academy. And any effort to weaken language in the Coast Guard's harassment manual conjures up images of Operation Fouled Anchor, where leadership covered up an investigation into sexual assaults at the Coast Guard Academy.
So what happens now?
Well, the Coast Guard, which is part of the Department of Homeland Security, has been without a commandant since President Trump fired Admiral Linda Fagan shortly after he took office, in part because of her focus on DEI initiatives. When Admiral Kevin Lundy took over as acting commandant, he suspended the Coast Guard's harassment policy. Lundy has been nominated to become the next commandant. His nomination hearing was Wednesday, but the committee has not announced when they will vote.
That's Steve Walsh of member station WHRO. Thank you.
Thanks, Juana.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Progressive Insurance, home of the Name Your Price tool, so drivers can see coverage options at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. Price and coverage match limited by state law. From the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, RWJF is a national philanthropy working toward a future where health is no longer a privilege but a right. Learn more at rwjf.org. From the NPR Wine Club, now shipping to additional states. Whether purchasing a few wines or joining the wine club, every purchase supports NPR. Available to adults 21 or older. NPRWineClub.org. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
You are listening to 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids and 90.5 KBXE Bagley Bemidji. We are Northern Community Radio, telling the stories of the people and land of Northern Minnesota through music, news, conversation, and events. Operating translator K210DR in Brainerd at 89.9. Listen at KAXE.org or on your smart speaker. We need people like you to support this local media. Text the word donate to 218-326-1234. Thank you. We receive support from Rapids Brewing Company, a place for gathering and community featuring live music multiple times a week, farm fresh food, and rotating beers from their own brew house. More information about their events, music, and menu available at rapidsbrewingco.com. Weather tonight, mostly cloudy skies with lows 21 to 31 degrees. Tomorrow, mostly cloudy, becoming sunny, highs in the mid to upper 40s, south winds 5 to 10 miles per hour, gusting up to 20 miles per hour.